have traveled a great distance to bring you this message from our sponsor, sparkplugcoffee.com. Coffee lovers know that the key to making a great cup of coffee is starting with freshly roasted beans. But Gort knows it's impossible to know when the coffee you buy at the grocery store or your local cafe was roasted. That's why it's time to switch to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that are always directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But what makes Sparkplug special is that they deliver this quality coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto, so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. You will taste the difference. Sparkplug even offers autopilot set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. The choice is simple. Switch to Sparkplug and start enjoying the best coffee you've ever had in your own kitchen, or remain in your present course and face stale, mediocre coffee. The decision rests with you.
Also annihilation. Kill people for not drinking the right coffee.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Klaatu, Barada, hello, movie freaks, and many thanks for earing up the next 100 project. Our previous goal to talk about the 123 American Film Institute movies is long done, so now we just check out a random assortment of movies. And if spoilers chap your hide, get out of here. I'm the judgmental alien, Ryan Ellis, and co-hosting as always is my cold, emotionless robot, Gort-like chum, and wife, Bev.
That's me.
That is you. All right, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, The Day the Earth Stood Still. Not exactly a quick title, is it? Anyway, the main character, Klaatu, in The Day the Earth Stood Still is an alien. How many other movies that made AFI's Top 100 Cheers list feature aliens? Is it 2, 4, 7, or 0?
I counted 4.
You're correct.
And one of them is, I guess, borderline, because it is 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Not actually aliens, but they're an underpinning in the whole thing.
Yeah, and there's alien intervention. It's like you see what they do, but you never actually see them. Mm-hmm. The other three movies are E.T. Extraterrestrial, Star Wars, and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Mm-hmm.
Lucas, Spielberg, and Kubrick are the other guys, along with Robert Wise directing The Day the Earth Stood Still. So those movies are all cheerful, alien-infested pictures. All right, the next 100 Project's 41st motion picture, The Day the Earth Stood Still, was nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists, but it didn't make it. 20th Century Fox released the flick in September 1951, so that makes it 65 years old now. It had a fairly big budget and grossed a nice sum of buckaroos for the Fox folks. Say that 3 times fast. Okay, Bab, explain this old movie to people with the skinny.
Michael Rennie is Klaatu, an alien who arrives in Washington in a spaceship along with a laser-eyed robot named Gort. Upon arrival, Klaatu is immediately shot by a trigger-happy soldier, then escapes a military hospital to blend in and learn about human life. Patricia Neal is Helen, and Billy Gray is her son, Bobby. They befriend Klaatu and help him in his mission. At the end of the movie, we finally hear the powerful message he was sent to deliver to all mankind.
Which is, in a nutshell, do as we say, or we'll execute every motherfucking last one of you!
It's true. He's supposed to be this peaceful alien, but he's basically coming there to say, if you fuck with us, you're a cinder.
You get one chance.
Yes!
One warning. They really haven't had any warnings as many times as we would have messed up back in the 50s, and we certainly have since. It'd be nice to have more than just one shot at it. All right, we'll get into the story in a second, but first some numbers. The Rotten Tomatoes critics, 94% of them liked The Day of the Earth, etc., etc. 50 fresh and 3 rotten, and 87% of audiences. But the Keanu Reeves remake got 21% of critics on Rotten Tomatoes and 27% of audiences. Deadly bad scores for the Reeves remake. I do know that one was more about the environment. There's even that line in the trailer. If you die, the Earth survives. If you survive, the Earth dies. Something along those lines.
Okay. Have you seen that version?
Yeah. I don't remember much about it except that Reeves is in it, Jennifer Connelly, and I think Jaden Smith plays her son. I don't know if it was 21% on Rotten Tomatoes worthy, meaning it was that bad, but it was not good either. Anyway, back to a few numbers here. Bosley Crowther pissed on this movie in his review. He was one of the main critics back in the 50s. And according to Wikipedia, this may not be true because I read somewhere else it was lower than this, but they've got that it was 10th at the 1951 U.S. box office, so it did okay. Quo Vadis was number one that year, and all the 1951 AFI movies that we covered a couple years ago were in the top 10. So A Place in the Sun, Streetcar Named Desire, African Queen, and what's the last one?
Oh gosh, I don't remember.
Oh, well, our longtime listeners know what I've forgotten. It's probably going to come back to me in the middle of this podcast, and I'll just throw it out there like I've got Tourette's or something. So anyway, hit us with your thoughts.
It was okay. It has really strong beginning and end, but the in-between is really just this bloat of creechy, eye-rolling moralizing.
Pudgy gut?
Yeah, it has a pretty pudgy gut, and I was bored.
Oh, you didn't tell me that when the movie was over.
Well, I really did like the beginning and end a lot, but okay. When he's walking around with Bobby learning about humans and illustrating to us dum-dums that, if only we could get along, then we won't be destroyed by aliens.
Of course they cast an uppity Englishman because, of course they would. How could it not be? Actually, the idea there was, rather than go with Spencer Tracy, who they did offer the role to, and he said no, or Claude Rains, they decided to go with somebody who was unknown, so it does come across that he's more an alien because no one really knew who he was.
That is a good choice. Plus, Claude Rains, what a strange choice that would have been.
I think Spencer Tracy's even weirder because he was too well known. Fair. We see it more now where people are even bigger stars because we can't escape their Keanu stardom. Reeves. Yeah, maybe so. Mm. It's hard for us to really believe them and the roles that they're in. So many actors. It's not their fault, but they really aren't believable in their roles because they are Tom Cruise, they are Jack Nicholson, they are Meryl Streep, rather than being Bob, Tom, Mary, whatever their names might supposedly be. So this guy is supposed to be from Mars, or maybe it's Venus. That's what I read online. The numbers he gives is not that far away. You'd think that it would be from many galaxies away, but supposedly the distance he gives to the military guy, maybe it's the chief of staff of the president. But anyway, it's not that far away, so I guess he could be
250 million miles, he says.
And that's not that far, so he's maybe a Martian. They set the movie in Washington, but the only shooting that was actually done there was with doubles and second unit. This is one of those movies that has a pretty big scope, but it was actually shot mostly on sound stages, and the actors never even went to D.C.
Which is funny, because a lot of the critics praise the naturalism in it, calling it like a documentary style for the location shooting.
Impressive on Wise's part to make that work. The thing that isn't the documentary style is there's quite a bit of hammy acting, especially from the supporting cast. Rennie is believable enough, and Patricia Neal is a very talented actress, but some of the other cast members are really laying on the old ham.
Well, you complain all the time about bad kid actors in classic films.
He wasn't as bad as I expected.
He's not that bad.
I hadn't seen this movie in a long time, but I've seen it several times. And I expected the whole, oh gosh, kind of acting we got from that kid in Pride of the Yankees when Lou Gehrig hits the home run for him.
Yeah.
And he wasn't even as bad as most actors were in that era, where it's the, I think I'm this Edward G. Robinson clown. And so many of them were like that. But back to the beginning of the story. So, of course, aliens head straight for America, because why would they go anywhere else? But then it's an American story, so you have to cut them that slack.
Well, in fairness, in 1951, aliens who are worried about nuclear weapons would go to the only country that had ever used nuclear
weapons. That's true. That's a fair point, yeah. But once Klaatu gets there and has his message of peace, he even says, I come in peace, kill it! That trigger-happy, stupid soldier. I pointed out to you during that scene, those two guys that are in that tank are on a tank.
I know.
Yet they still pull handguns. But anyway, when the one shoots Klaatu, it's this whole parody, The Simpsons have done it, where it's Burns is drugged up in one episode. I bring you peace and love. And they even have, I think it's Wiggum. Willie says it.
Get it!
Yeah, right. Kill it! Kill it! And they don't reference this movie directly, but I think maybe indirectly they were. But then they did judge us right. They sent a goon along with Klaatu on his peace mission because we really can't be trusted. If the message at the end of the movie was given, then you said it in your spark plug sponsor, change your ways or you're a burning cinder. Do you think the modern era that we would actually listen to that and change our ways? I think there's zero chance of that.
Well, they suggest in the movie, they never actually get all the politicians in a room together. They get the scientists together to listen to his message. But they can't really agree to meet up. They fail in their mission to get everyone to hear his message. I think they're suggesting in that movie that they could never accomplish that. Just like, I agree with you, today is no better. People are just as petty, bickering, and greedy about their own power and status.
Can you imagine Trump and the ISIS leaders, Angela Merkel, Putin, all standing there listening to this guy and saying, yep, gotta change now.
Yeah.
No, they want to shoot him again. In fact, they shoot at him in the beginning of the movie. Don't kill him. They just injure him. And then they do kill him later, but he has his E.T. / Gandalf moment. And Gandalf's probably a better representation. Well, maybe E.T.'s about the same. But he only comes back to life for a short time. It even says so. Only the Almighty can make you live forever, which was something that Robert Wise and the writer Edmund H. North, who wrote Patton, interesting comparison. This is kind of a military film, but that's obviously a very military film. But they hated that idea, and the studio, I guess actually the censors, imposed that on them. It's got to be that God, and they didn't say the word God, but only the Almighty can actually determine all this kind of thing.
Yeah, the screenwriter thought that he was being pretty subtle about insinuating the same as E.T. and Gandalf are kind of Jesus-y figures. Mm-hmm. North intentionally wanted Klaatu to be a Jesus figure. That's why when he goes among humans, he takes the name John Carpenter.
Jesus Christ.
And also he's a carpenter. J.C., yeah, and a carpenter. And then there's just other parallels, like violence is done upon him, and he turns the other cheek. Mm-hmm. And
that's right.
He is killed and then is resurrected briefly before he ascends to the heavens. And he brings a message of peace. He's a foreigner from the heavens who brings a message of peace to the people of Earth. I disagree that it's a message of peace. It's really a threat.
Yeah, that's why I said they'll kill every motherfucking last one of you. Pulp Fiction comes through for me again.
He's trying to say, you know, our society lives in peace and look what we've accomplished.
But they also sound like they were threatened by the same robots and then they learned the hard way, so they're living in fear. It reminds me of the whole Nixon thing when he pulled them out of Vietnam. He said, peace with honor. Well, this is peace with fear.
If it took fear to make the people of Earth behave like grown-ups, I would take it at this point.
Well, true, because they're not acting like grown-ups in America right now, as we know.
We're plenty of other places in the world.
Well, true. We were going to talk about the election on one of our podcasts. I guess it would have been the Three Colors Trilogy, which was after the election. But you made the point, well, we'll just probably end up talking about it in a future podcast. Well, now we have a political one with a president even mentioned, so we can certainly talk about it in this one. Like I said, the guy in charge in a couple of months would probably just say, blow that ship up, and that wouldn't work, and then we'd all be dead because a moron is in charge of all these things. You're right, though, that it's scientists who listen to the message. I'm not sure that the movie's saying there aren't some politicians scattered in there, although how could they have possibly been gotten together that quickly from that many parts of the world? But in any case, they would probably be ignored. That's another question I have. I don't have reasonably good questions in this podcast. I probably should have had some. But if that question was asked now, who's the greatest living person? Well, I guess it's a scientist. Would that be the answer if someone said that now? Would anyone say Neil deGrasse Tyson, who isn't probably the greatest scientist, but he's the most charismatic, well-known science-type person? I don't know who it would be. It'd probably be Kanye West or some athlete. People would generally answer that. Maybe they'd say the president, whether it be the current one or the future one.
They might say Elon Musk.
Okay, yeah. Businessman who's also a bit of a scientist.
Yeah, a little leans more science-minded business entrepreneur.
But it sure as hell wouldn't be the Einstein-esque Sam Jaffe character in this movie. That's a guy who was witch hunted. We haven't talked about this in a while. We're back in the 50s with this movie. We talked about 1951 and movies like On the Waterfront, which was 54, actually. But in that era, we had the witch hunt going on with communism. McCarthy was doing all that kind of stuff.
It was going on. The HUAC trials were happening in Washington while the second unit was shooting in Washington.
Yeah, ironic. And Sam Jaffe had no career for a while there. Yeah. And he happened to get this one performance in before he was, well, maybe he had a few others, but this is one of the last big performances he had for a long time. Then he was in Ben-Hur at the end of the decade, and after that mostly did TV. That's a common theme for a lot of these actors doing TV, which I guess is kind of true in the 50s. As big as TV is now, when you look at movies of this era, generally, the actors, even if they're fairly big names, did some TV, if not a lot of it, and sometimes that's all they did as their career progressed.
So you mentioned that Dr. Barnhart is this obvious stand-in for Einstein, and that was absolutely intentional by the filmmakers, and a little bit controversial because it's hard for us to remember now that in the post-war, Einstein was a bit of a controversial figure. He was a supporter for world government and UN, and he was opposed to loyalty oaths. He was very vocal about his fears about the potential for atomic power. His passion for world peace got him branded a communist. So convenient, I suppose, that Jaffe played this character who was himself a communist, apparently, or communist-leaning, and got himself in trouble.
I want to go back to the beginning of the movie, though, because I have a few wisecracks to make. One thing we talked about when the movie was on was everyone's pretty dour about a visitor from space. There's no true panic, and there's no real joy. It's somewhere in between. Everyone's kind of matter of fact. I get the military being that way because they know things, or at least you can believe they know things that we don't know.
They're responsible for protecting the people, so I can see how they would have a different perspective.
And maybe they actually met aliens, if you want to believe that whole Area 51 stuff. 1951, Area 51. But everyone else just seems like, oh, okay, whatever.
They're not nearly impressed enough. I do feel like if aliens ever did land on Earth in this fashion, the people of Earth would collectively actually unify and at the very least, change their perspective dramatically, maybe for short term, the way like big events, big world events have the tendency
to... Bring us all together,
yeah. But at the very least, we would all be seriously interested in what's going on. You see the crowds around the spaceship? There's no crowds, first of all. Maybe there's a smattering of 100+ people who show up to take a look at the spaceship. Then at night, nobody really...
Two guards! And even when Gort vaporizes the ones that are there at one point, the next night, or whenever it's supposed to be, maybe a couple nights later, two guards again.
Yes!
The night of the meeting, in fact, too, which is supposed to still be happening. I love the idea that scientists can go around this spaceship when the military has made it very clear this is a dangerous place to be.
And their reaction to the very first visitor from outer space is the first chance they get to try to get into the ship, which means they're trying to ruin the ship to get inside. There's a guy with a blowtorch just working away at it. Like, I can't believe I can't burn a hole in this spacecraft. I can't believe I can't just haphazardly destroy a flying saucer. Why are you trying to do that? He's got to go home somehow.
I think when it comes to the modern era, we would be extreme. We'd either try to obliterate that thing with a nuclear weapon, even in Washington, or yes, we would be of the type, like you said, rallying around and trying to do the whole sort of, my God, it's an alien, or even more so, it might be a matter of treating him like he is Jesus, or like he is a God, not a Jesus figure, but the actual one, because everyone wants the rapture to happen, not everyone, but so many people who believe in that stuff want that to happen. So they would probably be just, well, like you said, they would be a lot more than 100 people deep. They'd be 700, 800, 10,000 people deep around Washington. People would be congregating in the whole world, certainly the whole country.
And there would be an outcry of people who would just want the government to obliterate them, to drop a nuke on them. Fear would be the primary response, I think.
And since we're in the middle of the Cold War at this point, I mean, the early part of the Cold War being 1951, you can't blame them for expecting Russians to strike. So when the movie begins, it's not really their fault for being suspicious that it is the Russians until they realize that it's not. But when that UFO lands on a baseball diamond, that really bothered me because it's canceling so many summer games.
I know. Think about all those games that have nowhere else to play
now. Postponed.
Four baseball diamonds that got decommissioned.
That
because of that.
Son of a bitch, Klaatu. Wish somebody'd shoot you again. There's a few good lines in the film. One of them is, Klaatu says this, he's impatient with stupidity.
Mm.
And again, that applies so much more now than it probably did even in 1951, because Earth has just gotten more and more stupid. We seem to learn nothing, including our recent election. But then the other more famous line, the most famous line in this movie by a mile, is Klaatu, Barada, Nikto. That's beloved in sci-fi circles. George Lucas and Sam Raimi use it in some of their movies. Lucas and his Star Wars prequels and Raimi, and I think it was Army of Darkness.
Yes, that's the word he has to say to destroy the Necronomicon, I think.
Okay. And that is a line that probably should have made the quotes list, but did not. It was at least nominated. Now, when Klaatu has to impress upon everyone how powerful, not so much he is, but his mission is, he and Gort and the ship to a degree, he does the no electricity montage and turns power off for the entire world. And the montage goes on a little long. In fact, a lot long.
Oh, yeah. Who's going to make our malts?
I think we get it, and they show more and more clips, the fact that the power's off. All daytime scenes, by the way, and of course they would be nighttime scenes over in Europe.
I'm sorry, where? Europe? What, oh, the rest of the world? What?
Who cares about them? Yeah. Well, Russia, I think, at least. Well, they do show a scene in Russia, but it's daytime there, too, and it shouldn't be. But anyway, it is summer. I guess you'd argue maybe that, later hours, but no, that's just typical Hollywood. We're the only ones that matter. Now, when we get towards the end of the film, and they're going after Klaatu, they finally found him. I love the satirical reaction. Probably isn't really that satirical, but it seems that way now. That they mobilize the whole military to find one alien who has not proven to be aggressive. He has not proven to be aggressive. Gort has, granted, but Klaatu has not.
Well, Gort is his robot. It's fair to say, okay, like, your robot has killed two soldiers, so we can assume you're aggressive. But they decided to go aggro on him as soon as he went missing, period. As soon as he escaped their custody, that was it. They were, like, kill on sight.
One thing that would not happen now is he could be hiding in plain sight the way he does for so long in this boarding house with Patricia Neal and Billy Gray, because no one reasonably recognizes him. He's got the helmet on the entire time in the beginning of the film, and then at Walter Reed Hospital he's been seen, but not by that many people, and I guess he keeps away from the military well enough, so I'll buy that. But now his picture would be taken, people would have cameras out. Okay, now in the park that wouldn't work because he had the helmet on, but they would have pictures, the military would have taken those, and then it would just be flooded everywhere on social media and just regular newscasts, and everybody would be pointing him out instantly as soon as he gets to that boarding house, caught.
And in this day and age, it would only be everybody who wasn't busy in the middle of writing a think piece or an open letter or, you know, some kind of post that they just really hope to go viral. I'll point out another bit of 1950s sci-fi laziness, which is that Klaatu is suspiciously, coincidentally, identical to humans, except that his technology has allowed them to outlive us significantly.
The reason he speaks English is because they've been studying that, so I guess you can let them have that little thing there.
They even go as far as to show, like, an x-ray with his rib cage, and they're like, there's the heart and lungs, right where they belong. Just how, you know, on any individual planet, a species would ultimately evolve to turn to humans. Which I guess if you're making a movie that is acknowledging God, then I suppose that would be intelligent design. That is how it would work.
Because everything's made in the image of God, at least the human-type characters. Yeah, that's true.
It's yeah.
Not what was wanted by the people who made the movie, though. That's one reason why Stanley Kubrick, we said, 2001, is debatably an alien film that made the Cheers list. He didn't want to have the typical kind of aliens. Mm. Spielberg did something different in Close Encounters, where you have different types of aliens. Most of them are still human-like, though.
We haven't seen it yet, but Arrival, which is in theaters now, we're going to see on Friday. In the trailer, you do see the aliens, and they do not look at all like humans.
That's
they look dramatically different. Just from what I can make up from the trailer, more like squids.
That's almost a cliche, though, too. Independence Day did that.
Yeah, that's true.
I like the notion, even though he was being a dick, but Marlon Brando said in Superman that he wanted to be a floating bagel. Which is, of course, ridiculous. But knowing Brando, there may have been an element of actual sense to that, which is, why can't an alien be a bagel-like thing, or just looking like a rock, or a blade of grass, or something we can't even recognize at all?
That's a very Douglas Adams view of the universe as well.
It's also Brando's being lazy, not wanting to do the movie he got paid a lot of money for.
Yeah.
All right, so the ending, when Klaatu gives his message to the scientists, and I guess some world leaders are there at least. The president's not. He could be, but he's not there.
Yeah, we never meet the president, do we?
It is a bit humbling for an effete alien to lecture an entire planet. I also suggest this. The aliens must have a Death Star, because how else do they turn an entire planet to cinders?
Yeah, for a race that is so against violence, they sure have some big bat to wield around.
I guess you could argue they would send Gort or keep him there, or send a lot more Gorts, and it would just slowly but surely be that they'd wipe out the Earth. I mentioned Independence Day. I guess you could argue that's the way they would do it, because Independence Day is going from big city to big city. That's what the ships are doing, and had the Americans, of course, again, not found a way to fight back, then they eventually would have killed us all. So maybe that's what David Stood Still is going for here, too. It's not just you blown up in one fell swoop, like in Star Wars.
It doesn't really matter. They've proven that they have a tremendous amount of power. They can do the power outage, and even to specifically keep hospitals open
and airplanes.
So they clearly are technologically advanced enough for us to just trust that when they say they can turn the planet to cinder, they can turn the planet to cinders.
Not many movies leave their story so open-ended, or end on a scolding. We've mentioned Close Encounters in this podcast. That one ends open-ended for sure. Dreyfus goes off with the aliens. We don't really learn what they're all about. They bring other people back, and then they take him and go back into the heavens. But that one ends on a note of hope. It's almost like this is the first act of what could have been two or three other movies, and maybe there would have been some kind of big ending where we all are living together on some other planet, or aliens are living on Earth. Who knows, right? But this one ends on the whole nah thing from Klaatu, which we deserved, but not many movies do that, where it's, learn, you stupid idiots. Okay, Michael Rennie was also in The Robe a couple years after this, a huge hit about Jesus' robe, so there'll be mentioned Jesus again. And he played Harry Lime on the Third Man TV series as well, so he didn't have a huge career, but those are pretty important roles. The other thing we said about the JC thing, John Carpenter, Jesus Christ, John Coffey in The Green Mile, very unsubtly is another Jesus character with JC for initials. Patricia Neal, who is Helen, we saw her in Breakfast at Tiffany's earlier this year, where she was 2E, and she won an Oscar for Hud, which is a movie we should watch, if not next year, then maybe the one after. I mean, that would be an anniversary movie. It's 1963, so that would be 2018. She worked for 60 years and had one hell of a good career, really. I mean, then again, these three movies are her most famous, Day There Stood Still, Breakfast at Tiffany's, and Hud. Helen, though, is a trusting woman, loaning out her son to a stranger.
I know.
Ah, the 50s.
Lucky for all of humankind, Klaatu happened to meet the child Bobby and not some undisciplined spaz kid.
The ones that talk like Edward G. Robinson in the 30s. Oh, I'll show you there, alien!
Bobby's so impossibly sweet. He meets Klaatu for one day and then he's like, Mr. Carpenter's my best friend!
Yeah, we had a good laugh over that.
He has the discretion of a golden retriever.
He has no other friends, I guess. It's got to be his best friend just by default.
That's pretty sad.
It is I'm the summer, sorry, so maybe Bobby. His friends went to some other place, and he's a DC kid, I guess. He's just waiting till September to have his real friends come back. Hugh Marlowe plays Helen's love interest. He was in All About Eve, and I remember I told you this story on that podcast that Nicholas Meyer, who did Star Trek 2 and 6, I think it was, he's on the commentary with Robert Wise, and he regularly rips into Marlowe for how bad he is in this film. And I don't think he's that bad, but he's definitely pretty wooden. That was just the way he was in All About Eve as well, because he plays, I forget her name, but Celeste Holmes' husband in that film, the one that writes the plays that they all do. And he ended his career on a soap opera, Another World. Maybe that's appropriate for his acting style that Nicholas Meyer hated so much.
Yeah, and in this movie he's playing the guy who cares more about getting into the paper than he does about saving Earth from certain death.
Or keeping his fiance, Helen, or doing the right thing. Yeah, yes. It's all about being famous. You'll respect me more when I'm in the paper.
Yeah, they definitely rip on human nature, and that is probably one of the most transparent criticisms.
It is funny, though, hearing a guy many years later rip on another guy's actor, because Wise never actually says, yeah, he sucked ass. He's probably thinking, leave my actor alone.
Yeah.
I was the one who directed him, you dick. But it was actually a pretty fun commentary. And when you've got Wise and Meyer on that commentary, one thing that's fun about that is that one of the many movies that Wise did was Star Trek The Motion Picture, and then Meyer did the very next one, which is probably the most famous one, Star Trek The Wrath of Khan. So the kid playing Bobby, Billy Gray, worked for 50-plus years. He's nearly 80 now. His best-known thing, I mentioned TV series before, and that was Father Knows Best, a pretty famous show from the 50s or 60s, whatever the hell that was. The last actor we got to mention is the one who played Gort, Locke Martin. He's tall, but he was very weak, and he couldn't even carry Helen. You can blatantly see the wires on her when he picks her up. You could see it on the old DVD. You could probably see it on the worst print that's ever been aired, but on the Blu-ray, which was fantastic, by the way. My God. They need George Lucas to come back and fix that, clean that up a little bit.
And they just cast him because he was 8 feet tall. Yeah. I think he was an usher at Grauman's.
That's where I read, too.
Yeah, that's where they found him. Clearly he had giantism, and that's probably what made him weak and made him struggle to stand in the suit and stay still and carry anything. He's probably one of my favorite things about the movie, because there is something so eerily menacing about this robot that doesn't speak, that just commits violence, or stands perfectly statue still.
Because that is a statue in a lot of those scenes.
Yeah, but it's eerie, and he's impenetrable, and he's just sitting there waiting for orders, and you have no idea what he's capable of, and you have no idea what he's going to do, and whether he can do it on his own, or whether he needs to take orders from Klaatu, and he's a really menacing character.
Well, the key to the line, Klaatu, you brought a Nikto, is that that stops Gort from wiping out the Earth.
Yeah, it's like a safe word.
When Gort finds out that Klaatu's dead, he would have wiped out all of us, which is what Klaatu's saying will happen if we don't learn our lesson. So when Klaatu tells Helen that before he does get shot, thank God, or else we wouldn't be here right now.
Oh, another thing about Gort is he's very heavily featured in the poster, which I want to talk about just because we don't usually talk about posters, but
it's a good one.
It's a good one, but it's also criminally misleading. It's just so flagrantly a lie. Here, I'm showing it to Ryan, and I'll describe it to everyone.
We'll include a link on the website as well for this.
Yeah, let me describe it. The robot is easily 2 to 3 times the size he appears in the film. He's looming over a mob of soldiers and terrified onlookers who have rifles pointed at him while he zaps them with his laser vision. But the worst part is that he's cradling this bodacious blonde in a low-cut dress.
Oh, let me see. Scroll back up. Oh, yeah? Not bad?
And I don't know who to feel worse for. Patricia Neal, who's determined just too basic to appear in the poster, or the teenage boys who bought a ticket and sat through the whole movie without ever seeing this sexy damsel in distress.
She's kind of hot, but she's not a blonde with big boobs.
It's flagrant false advertising.
Well, Locke Martin was credited as Giant 4 times in his brief acting career. That's pretty much all he did when he acted. He only lived till about 42, I think it was.
It's common for people with giantism.
The most famous giant with giantism would be Andre the Giant, the wrestler. And he lived longer than 42, and he was physically able to do all kinds of great things. For a guy as big as he was remarkably agile. But we'll tell the story when we do Princess Bride next year, and we are doing Princess Bride in 2017. By that point, as huge as he could barely even lift Robin Wright, let alone anybody else.
Yeah, he struggled. He suffered horribly his whole life with pain, discomfort, illness, and all the things that come along with
it. And he was starting to go really downhill by that point.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, their director, Robert Wise, who shot a few movies that we've covered, West Side Story and The Sound of Music, which are monster hits and pretty popular podcasts for us as well. But a wide range of movies, box movies like The Setup, I mentioned Star Trek The Motion Picture, Somebody Up There Likes Me, another boxing movie with Paul Newman that put him on the map. And I could go through his resume for another 5 minutes. He made a lot of films. This one was different than most. I don't think he did sci-fi very often. But you got to admire a guy who can be a journeyman, but also be a good journeyman. And he was an editor for Wells on Citizen Kane. That was one of his first jobs.
That's how he met Bernard Herrmann, I think.
That's right. His writer, Edmund H. North, did co-write Patton with Francis Ford Coppola. Didn't have a lot of other screenplays in his credit, but I do love that. You've got a sci-fi movie and then a realistic movie about an actual person, Patton. He based it on Harry Bates' 1940 novel, Farewell to the Master.
Yeah, they definitely changed the plot significantly. The novel's quite different. In the novel, The Visitor, Klaatu is murdered immediately by a madman.
That makes sense.
Yeah, then the story is about the journalist who's watching the robot every night react to his companion's murder. And many of the elements they did keep are the Gort part of the story. They're similar to the book, the way he stands still, the attempt to contain him with glass decks. And in the end of the novel, it is revealed to the journalist that Gort was the master all along, and Klaatu was working for him. He was his minion. Yeah.
Well, in effect, that's what's true about this, too.
No, Klaatu is the boss of the robot.
Yeah, but he even says that the robots.
Oh my gosh, they say robots so much.
Especially the making of, I think Julian Blaustein, the producer of the film, but somebody in the making of, I remember very distinctly in this one.
It was always hurting says robots. My brain. It was hurting my brain.
But I think that you could argue that because he even says, these robots, do all the work for us, or at least they are watching over us, and they'll punish us if we do wrong. That really makes them the masters.
They are their policemen, right?
Yeah, just because they don't speak doesn't make them not in charge. And Julian Blaustein, the producer, another guy like Wise, who did so many different kinds of films, westerns, rom-coms, adventure picks, and here a sci-fi film. The movie is 1:37:1, of course, because this is the year before they started doing widescreen. The Robe was the first widescreen movie, as far as I understand it. I mentioned that earlier with Michael Rennie being in that movie. The Blu-ray is wonderful, especially for a movie as old as this one is. It's up there with some of the best Blu-rays I've ever seen that are older. I mean, obviously modern Blu-rays are going to look better because they should.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know if they've done a restoration or if they've just always taken really good care of the print.
Probably a restoration.
It's phenomenal. Yeah. And the special effects, they look good even today. They didn't get too ambitious with at least the spaceship, which was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright.
Mm-hmm. And when it has the opening of the door, that was just puttied over in a certain way. And when you light something, you can make it look like it just appears from nowhere. And then when it goes back in, they just reverse the film.
Yeah, it looked really good.
I don't like the sound effects, though. A little too much like the cartoon sound effects I watched when I was growing up. Justice League or something like that.
Chances are, though, the sound effects in those cartoons were inspired by The Day the Earth Stood Still and other science fiction movies.
Good point. Okay, well, the cinematographer shooting the movie that looks so great now, Leo Tover. He also shot Journey to the Center of the Earth and Spirit of St. Louis, so that was with Wilder and Jimmy Stewart. I was flying over the Atlantic Ocean. The editor, William Reynolds, look at these credits. We've talked about him plenty of times in our podcast. He did The Sound of Music, of course that was with Wise, The Godfather and The Sting, which we covered only a few months ago, back in, I guess it was February. And the music you just said at Bernard Herrmann, who did music for great films, especially Citizen Kane, Taxi Driver, and all those Hitchcock classics we covered for the Top Runner project. Not Notorious we did this year, but the other ones, Psycho, Rear Window, Vertigo, and... Not Rear Window, sorry. North by Northwest was the other one.
Yeah, and we can thank Bernard Herrmann for always associating the theremin with corny 50s sci-fi movies.
And the theremin music was new to movies. The electronic score was very new. Influenced a lot of people, especially Danny Elfman. And when you watch Ed Wood, you can really hear that theremin influence on that movie.
Speaking of influence, you can certainly hear the theremin and see influence of this movie a lot in Mars Attacks.
Right, that too, which I watched again recently and was so unmemorable that I forgot about it until you said it right now.
I'm like one of the few Mars Attacks apologists. I was very charmed by that movie, but I stand alone, apparently.
That was pretty funny, and I thought I was going to laugh more than I did. Okay, the influence, and there's quite a bit, the Keanu Reeves remake in 2008, which Scott Derrickson directed, and he's the guy who did the recent Doctor Strange. I saw that only a few weeks ago. Damn good movie, one of the better effects movies of the whole year. If that doesn't get nominated for the visual effects in 2016, that'll be a shame. The Abyss, the James Cameron movie, has a similar cut it out message, also delivered by aliens. In the extended cut, they show this whole thing where there's this giant wave, I think it's supposed to be in California, just sitting there. And the notion is, yeah, we can kill you anytime we want to with a huge tsunami, but we're not going to. So obviously Cameron was homaging Day of the Earth Stood Still, although other movies have done that kind of thing too. Contact doesn't really get into the notion that they're going to kill us, but the David Morse character, it's not really his character actually, but the alien who's impersonating Jodie Foster's father, hey, spoiler alert, but Contact is almost 20 years old, He says at one point, you're capable of such beautiful dreams and such terrible nightmares. So this movie's kind of going on
the same road. I think like the vein of aliens smugly judging us has certainly taken hold and frequently featured in sci-fi.
And because we are capable of great dreams, maybe that's why in this movie they didn't just say, well, fuck you, we'll kill you now, without the warning you're going to get, the one shot you get at it.
The other thing that seems to have become common in science fiction movies since the day the Earth stood still is the notion of this mysterious object that is just ominously doing nothing and impenetrable. A great example, the best example, is the monolith in 2001, which came after this film, so it's possible that they were inspired by this idea of the menace of a mysterious object coming from nowhere and sitting still. Also, this is like a way worse example, but they did this in Thor. Thor's hammer is sitting there and the whole army is trying to figure out what the deal is with it. In each case, they're impervious to our study or attempts to destroy them or affect them in any way.
And in that case, the Thor hammer, you have to be worthy to carry it. Well, you could argue that we're not worthy of the spaceship, the robot, or even the humanoid Klaatu.
There you go. Yeah, another great example of that theme.
And both District 9 and Arrival have spaceships, and Independence Day for that matter, hovering over.
Mm-hmm.
And in District 9, they're not sinister necessarily. Independence Day, of course, they are. In Arrival, we don't know yet. We haven't seen the movie, so maybe we'll talk about that briefly next week or something, or sometime soon if it's good enough, worth mentioning. We'll have to find a way to jam it in one of our podcasts. It has nothing to do with anything sci-fi. The last thing about influence is, did the film influence Ronald Reagan to try to mend fences with Russia? Because his notion was, well, what if some power came down from the heavens and threatened all of us? Maybe we should get rid of those nukes.
Yeah, he was known by his staff to have an interest in, quote, little green men. He was apparently an unabashed fan of the film and floated the scenario with Mikhail Gorbachev in 85.
Funny that movies can influence presidents the way they do, because I mentioned Patton, which was co-written by Edmund H. North. And Oliver Stone's theory, maybe he's not right, but he thinks that that's one of the reasons why Nixon went into Cambodia during the Vietnam War, because he saw this balls-out movie of, we're going to go win the war. And Nixon was reinvigorated rather than thinking, we're not winning this war. Maybe that's bullshit, but presidents can be influenced by films. And the guy who's going to be taking office in about 2 months, God knows what he can be influenced by. A tweet. I could probably get him going, for Christ's sakes. It seems like anybody could. All right, well, the awards and list section is the longest we've had in quite a while. There are no Oscar nominations, but it made the National Film Registry in 1995, along with American Graffiti, North by Northwest, and To Kill a Mockingbird. That's a diverse group of pictures. The Day the Earth Stood Still was 82nd on the Top 100 Thrills, 67th on the Top 100 Cheers, so it is the lowest ranked of those alien movies I mentioned on the Cheers list, and it's 5th in the sci-fi category of the Top 100 Genres, which is my favorite of those 10 genres. I like how diverse they are. It may not be the 5th best of those, but they're all kind of different, which is nice. And it was also nominated for the Top 50 Heroes, Klaatu, of course, the Top 25 Music Scores, and the Top 100 Quotes with Gort, Klaatu, Barada, Nikto. Oh, one thing about that, Helen has to say it multiple times for the robot to get it, which seems weird because the robot should get it right away.
Maybe it's an accent thing.
Well, a woman saying it too in 1951.
Oh, yeah, good point.
Oh, I also like the notion, by the way, in this film, the woman and the child are his compatriots and his companions and his helpers, not the grown men. He can't trust them. He can trust the woman and the child.
They're like the only non-grown white males in the cast. Oh, no, there's the
older
landlady.
Woman in the boarding house.
Yeah.
A couple women in the boarding house, I guess.
Okay.
Basically, no other people. And extras, of course, but yes. People with any kind of speaking role, pretty much men.
Also
the secretary for the Barnhart guy.
But Klaatu is strongly under the impression that the entire planet is Caucasian, I'm sure.
In the 50s, it was.
So the film was received with gratitude by the foreign press and the rest of the world in general. The Golden Globes created a special award just for it, for promoting international understanding.
I don't think they have that award anymore, do they?
No, they just, you know, and the Oscar created that award just for Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. We were so inspired by this film that we wanted to award it for this unique thing that it did. So maybe part of my blasé for this movie is being too far out of context of the time that it took place.
It's also so on the nose. You couldn't nominate the screenplay because the dialogue is, if not weak, then just pedestrian for the most part. But it's a good story. It's one of those things back before then, it should have been nominated for the story, because they had the story Oscar and they had the screenplay Oscar. The effects maybe could have been nominated. I think they had that award by that point. Yeah, they must have. And definitely the music score could have been nominated. Probably should have been nominated for what it's worth for Oscars and such. And looking back, hey, I mean, that was a strong year. I still haven't remembered the other 1951 movie. I'm going to kick myself and I'll look it up later. But it could have been Best Picture nominated. Maybe. But then again, as you said, you're not a big fan. Well, your last thoughts. Tell us what you thought in the end here on Day the Earth Stood Still.
Well, ultimately, it left me cold. Taking the position in favor of world unity doesn't really seem that brave to me, and an illustration of the frustrating tribalism of humans, well, that's hardly novel either. So when the backbone of the film is this intellectualization of these concepts, it just doesn't do much for me. Maybe it was contributing to the conversation back in 1951, but the concepts presented here is really taken as a given today, so...
In other words, it's just too dated.
Yeah, that's probably it.
I still like it a lot, but I can see why it's a 7.8 on the IMDb for what that's worth. Would we do it again? Because I picked this movie for us to do. But would we do it again if we had another shot at it? Maybe do something else, a little more pressing? Maybe. I haven't seen it in a long time, and I did enjoy seeing it all over again, but the acting seems pretty weak compared to some of the stuff we've seen this year and the last couple of years in our podcast. We haven't seen too many performances to stand out as bad as some of the ones in this movie, especially the supporting cast. Michael Rennie does a good job, but then he's given all these lines where you want to just say, okay, you're right, but fuck you to a certain extent. I kick in your alien balls. I get it. Shut up.
He's such a liberal elite.
Just fly away and leave us alone. But then again, the sequel to this movie would be all of us dying because we don't learn shit.
Yeah.
Especially now.
It would be like the novel. He would be dead before he finished the sentence, we come in peace.
I'm going to build a wall, and I'm going to make the aliens pay for it. Okay, enough about that bastard. Fucking piece of shit. We'll be talking about plenty in the podcast ahead, I'm sure, because he is going to be the president for 4 fucking years. All right, our next foray into movie reviewing will get us back to relatively modern stuff. We'll trek back 20 years and take a look at Danny Boyle's beloved drug flick, Trainspotting.
Starring my Scottish boyfriend, Ewan McGregor.
He can be on your laminated fuck list. Friends reference. Mm-hmm. People have seen Friends. We'll get that one. The coming attraction trivia for Trainspotting, not counting T2 as they're calling it, which they're going to release in a couple of months, early 2017, Trainspotting 2. Who has Danny Boyle worked with the most? The actor Robert Carlyle, the writer John Hodge, the producer Andrew McDonald, or the actor Ewan McGregor?
Oh, good question. All right, so for the answer to that, please tune in to next week's podcast. And in the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, and while you're there, check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered 187 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and 07 lists of the best Hollywood movies ever made. Every episode is available for free, and while you're there, rate us and review us. It helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
Bev, Klaatu, Parada, take us out of here.
And cut.
Gort. Gort. Gort.